This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he joins us live in studio on occasion on this little show to update us about all things space. How many classes you got this semester?
Just one big class for undergraduate students, and then I was teaching a Tuesday evening class for the School of Continuing Professional Studies that wrapped up last week. And we're running an online class for 28 teachers around Virginia this semester.
Oh, goodness.
So it's been a great experience. So it's an astronomy and space science class. The teachers are spread out all over the state. And so it's hard to bring them all in one place for a class. So we're teaching part of it online, part of it face-to-face.
Yeah. That's a challenge.
It is. But it's neat seeing the teachers and giving them the content that they need to go into the classroom and confidently teach astronomy, because now they know what's going on.
Yeah, and safe to say that most school teachers have never even taken an astronomy class.
That's right, because it's not required at the college level. Yet if they're a fourth or a sixth grade teacher, they have to teach astronomy. It's in the standards of learning, but they probably didn't have one at the college level.
Yeah. I was thinking about you this morning, Ed. I was getting my kids off to school, so one of those days when I'm in charge of breakfast and packing the snacks and lunches, and my son was looking at a book, and there was a word, and he said, O word. And he's trying to figure out what this O word is. And I said, that's observatory.
Oh, good.
And he was struggling. He could not get the, he's like, observe. And I'm like, you know, here it is. It's observe. And so he finally said it. And he looked at me and said, can we go to the observatory?
Excellent.
And I said, let's talk to Ed Murphy.
That's right.
We'll definitely go to the observatory. And y'all have public nights up there all the time.
That's right. First and twice a month, first and third Fridays of every month. So we'll actually be open this Friday from 9 to 11 because it's the first Friday of April.
Oh, good deal. Yeah. So this coming Friday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m.
Exactly.
And now I've been to one of those up there and it was packed.
Yep. It depends on the weather, and we don't. There's no prior reservations, so we really have no idea how many people will come up.
So it's first come, first serve. But there's a slew of telescopes all over the place.
That's right.
You had one outside, and there's the big one inside, and so you should have plenty of opportunity. Plus, there's a little museum up there, and all sorts of good stuff.
And there's always a faculty member giving a talk on either something new in astronomy or on the research that's done here.
That's terrific, and that is conveniently located up there, Observatory Hill.
Exactly.
At the University of Virginia.
That's right. It's at the very end of McCormick Road. McCormick Road winds through the university, and if you follow it down through the engineering school and across the street and then up to the top of the hill, just remember the observatory is on the very top of the hill, so just keep taking McCormick Road up to the top.
There you go. Now let's talk about this UFO made national headlines recently.
That's right.
That people in a lot of people in Virginia had seen some huge UFO and many, many thousands of people reported it. So fill us in.
So it was a Sunday evening about 9:40, and the residents of Tidewater, Virginia, the whole Tidewater area, saw this bright flash in the sky. They reported it variously as being bright green or white with red fringes to it, rapidly moving across the sky. And then about 2 minutes after it disappeared, they heard a loud boom and some rumbling. And so this is a classic description of a really bright meteor. In fact, when they get that bright, we call them a fireball entering the Earth's atmosphere and burning up in the Earth's atmosphere. And this one was good because it was over a populated area, so it was seen by probably hundreds of people, including a couple of amateur astronomers who knew exactly which direction. And they know that when you see something like this, the first thing you should do is look at your watch to record exactly what time it is.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of details about this thing.
And of course, tons of people saw it. People were calling in, you know, TV stations, police stations.
Calling us.
Weather Channel. They called you here.
Yeah. So they call, oftentimes, people will call the astronomy department thinking that we know what's going on in the sky.
What did I see?
That's right. And, and since most of the time we didn't get to see it, the best we can do is listen to how you describe it and try and figure out, try and explain what it might have been. And this is a beautiful example of the trouble of trying to figure out what it might have been. Because at first, astronomers said that they thought this was a meteor burning up in the Earth's atmosphere. And then an astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory was being interviewed, Jeff Chester, over this. And Jeff was running some calculations and saw that on Thursday, last Thursday, the Russians had launched a new vehicle to the International Space Station, a Soyuz rocket, carrying three people up to the space station. And the Soyuz rocket has a large second stage that's discarded and stays in orbit for a few days. And he noticed that it was supposed to re-enter sometime between late Sunday afternoon and early Monday morning, which was perfect. This was right in the middle of that window. And then when he calculated the orbit for this second stage, he saw that the orbit was passing right over Eastern Virginia at the moment that people saw this bright light in the sky.
Hello.
So Jeff Chester said that he was quoted in the paper as being 99.4% confident that that what people saw was a reentering rocket stage and not a meteor.
Now, tell us what a rocket stage is. It's just a big empty gas tank?
Big empty gas tank with the engines attached to it. And in every time we put a spacecraft in orbit, there's usually a giant first stage that doesn't have enough energy to make it to orbit. So it always falls back into the ocean. Or in the case of the Russian launch facilities, it falls back on land. And then there's a second stage, which often does make it into orbit. And sometimes it's in a lower orbit than the satellite and decays fairly quickly. Sometimes they're in a fairly stable orbit and they can be up there for decades.
Really?
Yeah.
So this was a big, huge, falling, empty gas tank off of a Russian rocket.
But that's what he thought. And the problem with that was is that Jeff Chester had the same amount of evidence that the rest of us had to go on, which is eyewitness reports of a bright light in the sky. The loud noise that they heard was probably the sonic boom as this thing comes down low in the atmosphere. It's traveling faster than the speed of sound. So you hear the loud boom and then the rumble afterwards. But it turns out then that the U.S. Strategic Command on Tuesday looked into this, and they sent out a little press release that said, in fact, that they were tracking the Russian booster. They weren't really tracking it, but they saw it reenter a few hours later over Taiwan. And in fact, it was not the Russian booster that they saw in Eastern Virginia.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so it was it probably was just a bright fireball, a meteor. And
really?
Yeah, so wow. Just probably something. The estimates I've seen are anywhere from the size of a small car down to something a little bit smaller than that.
Now, we've talked before about how people are tracking meteors out there so that we hopefully should know the bigger ones before they come into our atmosphere. Did this just not make somebody's list? It was too small?
It's too small. Yeah, this is too small to see ahead of time. This is too small to track over long distances. We probably, with the equipment we have today, we probably wouldn't even see this one. It's much smaller than 10 feet across. So we probably wouldn't even see this one before impact.
Wow. And so it just landed out there in the ocean somewhere.
Exactly. The people in Tidewater saw it going north-northeast, high up in the sky, which means it probably landed 50, 60, or 100 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, if anything survived. It's likely that, based on the size of it, that a good few chunks probably did make it all the way down and splashed out in the ocean out there.
Yeah.
Which is where most of them land anyhow, because the surface of the Earth is almost three-quarters water. So most of the
chances are it's going to splash.
It's going to end up in the ocean someplace. That's right.
We're talking with Ed Murphy, UVA astronomer. What are your other thoughts about UFOs? I mean, I know we've talked about those in detail in the past and life in space. And
yeah, it comes down to this question of what did I see in the sky? And the answer is for an astronomer, for a scientist, Carl Sagan put it best to say that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And claiming that we're being visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence is an extraordinary claim. And seeing a light moving in the sky that you don't understand is not extraordinary evidence. It doesn't rise up to the level of evidence that I need personally to believe that we're being visited by an extraterrestrial civilization.
Yeah. So, but UFOs are pretty common by definition.
By definition, that's right, just because they're an unidentified flying object.
And right.
It's very interesting when people often call us, we're happy to try and help them figure out what they saw in the sky. But when Venus is, earlier this winter, we had brilliant Venus up there in the western sky, and we would get a few calls a week from people asking, what's that bright light I see in the western sky? Most of them knew it was a planet, just wanted to know which one it was.
Right.
But we did get the occasional call from somebody that said, and it was moving around last night, and then I saw it the next night. It wasn't moving the next night, but it was moving that first night. So it couldn't be a planet or a star because it was moving, and it was just Venus. And it's just an optical illusion.
That if you stare at it long enough, it's going to move.
And in particular, if your first thought when you see something in the sky is that it's a UFO, you will try and find and subconsciously, unconsciously invent evidence to prove to yourself that it's a UFO and not just a bright star or planet.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen one?
A UFO?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I've pretty much recognized everything I've seen in the sky. I have seen, at the moment...
You're the type of guy that looks up at the night sky and you know what all that stuff is.
Exactly, right. And I have, the one experience I can relate is that when I was a graduate student here at the University of Virginia, we were out observing at our Fan Mountain Observatory south of town.
Yeah.
And we saw this very bright star-like object that had this bright haze around it that was slowly moving through the sky. And here we are, a bunch of graduate students in astronomy. We're looking at this going, I have no idea what that is. But our thought wasn't that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. It was a really interesting question of what it was. And then the next day we found out that it was a launch at Wallops Island. We were actually seeing the exhaust plume from a sounding rocket that was launched out of Wallops Island.
Oh, gosh. So, Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia. We're honored to have him live in studio. What's the story on that Russian rocket, the one that they thought it might have been this rocket, but
so
was not?
They've sent a new crew up to the International Space Station, the crew that's been on board right now. The two of the crew members have been up there since October, so this is almost 6 months for them. And more importantly, after 6 months, the Soyuz lifeboat that they keep attached to the space station, the spacecraft that they would use to escape in an emergency, is only rated to be in space for 6 months at a time. So it's time for them to come home on their old spacecraft and have two new crew members take over. And so the Russian spacecraft, interestingly, have three seats in them, but they only need to bring two new crew members up, so they have a spare seat. So they've sold that to a tourist, an American tourist who's going into space. Interestingly, the first time that an American any tourist, for that matter, has gone into space a second time. It's Charles Simonyi. He's a former executive at Microsoft. He was led the group that was responsible for developing Microsoft Office and all those applications we use all the time.
And that's what he's doing with his money.
And that's what he's doing with his money. So in 2007, he paid, it's estimated to be $20 million to go into space. And this time he paid $35 million is the estimate. So this will, and last time he spent almost 10 days in space. This time he'll spend 10 days in space.
Wow. He must not have been a good traveler the first time for them to bump the price up on him.
No, yeah, the price has gone up for a couple of reasons.
You want to come again, you'll pay more.
That's right. But actually, the real reason it was more expensive this time was he had to pay an extra $5 million to jump ahead of everybody else who are lined up for these flights that the Russians are offering on the Soyuz spacecraft.
Yeah.
So they have a special, you can think of it as the premier program for frequent flyers. For $5 million, he moved right to the head of the line.
Now, the U.S. hasn't done that yet, have we? We're not selling seats on the space shuttle.
We do not sell seats commercially. You could argue that a number of people who've gone up on the space shuttle over the years have been public relations. I mean, for example, a senator and a representative have both flown on the active senator and active representative have flown on the space shuttle. We've had a number of astronauts from other countries who've flown on the space shuttle. In some sense, you might consider them passengers, just not commercially paying
more
passengers.
PR type of passengers.
Exactly. Yep. But so the U.S. hasn't done that, has no plans to do that at all.
We're talking with Ed Murphy from the University of Virginia. What is this about the United Nations and upcoming events about the International Year of Astronomy?
That's right. 2009 is the United Nations has declared 2009 to be the International Year of Astronomy. It's the 400th.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the 400th anniversary of Galileo Galilei using his telescope to look at the night sky and seeing the craters on the moon, the moons of Jupiter. He didn't understand them, but he saw the rings of Saturn, the phases of Venus. And so there's a big year-long celebration of astronomy this year. And one of the keystone projects is happening starting tomorrow. It's called 100 Hours of Astronomy. It's a worldwide, essentially, star party where people will be, amateur astronomers and other astronomy groups will be taking people outside to look at the night sky and try and do this for 100 continuous hours around the world.
Wow.
So, yeah. So if you want more information on that, there's a website. It's www.100hoursofastronomy, all run together as one word, .org. And they have a webcast of 80 research telescopes around the world that will be doing short webcasts from each of the 80 telescopes.
Now, can I assume that the University of Virginia, that you're not going to be up on that telescope for 100 hours
no,
starting
that's
tomorrow?
No, that's right. Our public night on Friday night is our contribution to the 100
okay.
hours of astronomy.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Good
and
stuff.
No one group is staying. It's meant to be as night moves across the Earth that there will always be astronomy events going on for those 100 hours. But no one group is expected to.
Oh, okay.
Stay up for 100 hours.
And tell us the story. You sent me an email earlier about some story that just came out regarding a close call with one of the space shuttles. News that's just coming out now about something that happened years ago.
That's
a fascinating
right.
story.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. It's a story about one of the early space shuttle missions, or at least early compared to where we are right now in December of 1988. It was the STS-27 mission. It was a secret Department of Defense mission. Obviously, launching a space shuttle is not very secret, but everything that goes on board during the mission is completely secret. And it came out during the investigation of the Columbia accident that there was a serious problem on that mission with the thermal tiles on the underneath of the shuttle. And then the former commander of that mission, Hoot Gibson is his name. Gibson recently in an interview gave more details of what had happened. And it was really a remarkably close call back in 1988. So remember, this is 2 years after the Challenger accident, which happened in 1986.
Yeah, that was horrible.
It was. Gosh. And it was the second flight after the Challenger accident. So there was the return to flight mission, and this was the second one after that. And a lot of people forget that the space shuttle was not originally designed to be solely a civilian vehicle. It was, in fact, originally designed both with NASA civilian spaceflight in mind and Department of Defense missions. And there have been, throughout the years, a number of secret Department of Defense missions. And if you look those up on the web, you will see a shuttle launch and landing date, and it just basically says Department of Defense mission. There's no details as to what they did. So what we know,
what are they doing? You think putting up?
They're putting up satellites,
yeah, for the most part, to watch
spy satellites,
yeah,
intelligence gathering satellites, things like that. And that, in fact, that's what. So amateur astronomers then track these things, and the amateur astronomers have determined that what they did in 1988 was they released the LaCrosse-1 signals intelligence satellite into orbit around the Earth. So that was their big goal, was to go up there and release this satellite. And they may have even had to do a spacewalk. Nobody knows exactly what happened on that mission because it's even secret to this day. Even though LaCrosse-1 is no longer operational, we still have LaCrosse satellites in orbit. But it's rumored there may have even been a spacewalk on that mission, that they had some problem with LaCrosse-1 where two of the astronauts had to go out, spacewalk, and repair the satellite before leaving.
Right, right.
But what had happened was they got a call from Mission Control to use the robot arm with the video camera, the television camera on the end of the robot arm, to examine the underside of the shuttle, because 85 seconds after launch, a piece of insulation broke off the right-hand solid rocket booster and struck the bottom of the space shuttle, which is eerily similar to what happened to the Columbia accident. And in that case, it was foam from the external tank, not a solid rocket booster. But something had hit the shuttle.
The Columbia was the one that...
In 2003.
That fell apart over Texas.
Yeah, exactly. It burned up. And that was because a piece of foam, a giant piece of foam, struck the left wing and broke the carbon panels on the front of the wing that protected from the heat from reentry. And so the heat from reentry was able to penetrate into the wing, and the shuttle was lost.
And it just, as it came down in through the atmosphere, it just burned up and fell apart.
Exactly. Literally what happened was the wing fell off, because as this searing hot gas went through the struts that were holding the wing on, eventually it compromised the structural stability of that left wing. And the left wing folded up, and then they lost control and burned up on reentry.
So and then, of course, this is Columbia 2003,
three,
right?
Exactly.
So that burned up. It burned up on reentry, or it broke apart on the ground, or what?
No, it broke up on reentry.
So
they were very high, many miles above the atmosphere. Probably 40 miles above the surface
now,
of the Earth.
This is a morbid question, but those astronauts on reentry in Columbia, did they burn up, or did they just sort of fall out of a spaceship miles above the Earth that was falling apart?
What happened to them, we actually know more about this because NASA just this past winter released a report, in fact, on what happened to the Columbia astronauts and how they might make a scenario like that more survivable in the future. And it turns out the good news is, if there's any good news out of that they probably blacked out from lack of oxygen.
Okay.
One of the seven astronauts didn't have their helmet on. The others did not have the spacesuits completely sealed on reentry. And so they probably, from lack of oxygen, as soon as the hull of the space shuttle was breached, the oxygen, the atmosphere would leave very quickly and they'd black out almost right away.
Okay.
But what happened back in
1988? Yeah, back to 1988, yeah.
So they took the camera and they put it under the shuttle, and Hoot Gibson, the commander, noticed that there was a tremendous amount of damaged tiles underneath. And it's really eerie when you read his interview, because the very first thought that went through his mind was, we're dead. I mean, he'd been with the space shuttle program since before the shuttles had flown, and he'd never seen damage this bad on the tiles on the bottom of the shuttle. And so he called down to Houston and said, you need to take a look at this. The problem is it's a Department of Defense mission, and they won't let the astronauts do any television broadcasts. All the communications with the shuttle are blacked out because it's a Department of Defense mission. So NASA said, send us down some encrypted video. So they took some encrypted video, but instead of being a regular television camera, it took one frame every 3 seconds, and then had to encrypt that data and slowly send it to the ground. And then the pictures on the ground were really grainy. It turns out in the end that the engineers on the ground didn't understand what they were seeing, and they thought the astronauts were being fooled by tricks of light and shadow, so they radioed back up, "You're perfectly fine." And Gibson knew they weren't perfectly fine because he'd been with the space shuttle program. He knew this was the worst damage they'd ever seen, but he didn't press the issue. He said in hindsight he should have, but he didn't. Because that was just the way, that's one of the problems that you end up with the culture inside of NASA. Sometimes people are afraid to speak up about these things. And so he said another eerie statement he had in there was the day before landing, he was just floating, looking out the window, saying there was no reason to die, all tensed up, that he may as well just enjoy the view in the last day he had left. So.
And, of course, they came back in reentry, and there wasn't a problem.
There wasn't a problem.
Even though all those tiles were off.
That's right. And, in fact, Wayne Hale, who's a former director of the space shuttles, a former director of manned spaceflight, Wayne Hale said that it was a really close call, and it just goes to show how much redundancy and backup there was in that thermal protection system on the shuttle, that it actually did survive that amount of damage. But they were all shocked when they saw the damage when it came down.
And, of course, we're just now learning this.
Exactly.
Because, 20 years
again,
later.
It was a completely classified mission.
Wow. And that story is available online at spaceflightnow.com.
Exactly.
For the complete backstory on that. Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia. Ed, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.